Good morning, everyone. Thank you for allowing me to be here. It's an inspiration to see so many faces coming out on a Sunday morning, so eager to learn. May your eagerness to learn continue forever. It's amazing, a real inspiration. So our topic today, from Rabbi Akiva's house to Maxwell House. What does it mean? What are we going to be exploring? So we're talking about Haggadot. That's pretty obvious from the title. But what about the Haggadot? So we all sit every year at our Pesach Seder, and we read about various individuals, such as Rabbi Akiva, and their conversations at their table, discussing Yitziat Mitzrayim. The question I've always had, and I'm sure many of you have had as well, is when did it all begin? When did Jews start sitting around the table, discussing Yitziat Mitzrayim, stuffing our faces with matzah, drinking her grape juice, sitting around, schmoozing about Yitzias Mitzrayim, getting together with family members? When did it all begin? And has anything changed throughout the ages? And if it has changed throughout the ages, how? How does it differ from back then to what we do now? So we'll do a little bit of an exploration of really where things began and take ourselves up to modern day, 2016, the latest version of the Maxwell House Haggadah, which, as many of you know, you can pick up at your local supermarket, and over 50 million copies have been produced by the Maxwell House in the United States of America. So let's begin our exploration. When did it all start? So we know, if we look at the first source on your source sheet, we have way back in time. How far way back in time? Well, our first source is a biblical source, as you can see. Okay, the first source is from Parshat Ve'eschanan, and we begin with Kishach Bincha Machar Lemor Ma Ha'edu Va'Chukim Va'Mishpatim Asher Tziva Hashem Elokeinu Etzchem, which is, if your son asks you tomorrow, what are your edu, your chukim, your mishpatim, which God commanded you, Va'amarta Levincha Avadim Hayinu Leparu B'Mitzrayim Ve'utziyanu Hashem B'Mitzrayim B'Yad Chazaka. So we know already, biblically, we were talking about Yitzias Mitzrayim, the miracles that God did when we left the land of Egypt. How did it transform from that biblical era of us every year thinking, contemplating Yitzias Mitzrayim to the current form of a very standardized Haggadah? Obviously, in biblical times, they weren't sitting with their printed Maxwell House Haggadah, okay, and sitting at the Seder with all of the steps and talking about Yitzias Mitzrayim in the way that we have it. So how did it evolve? The next time we have a conversation of really where people are sitting down discussing Yitzias Mitzrayim in a more standardized form is in the Mishnah. So we have the next source, which is Mishnah Misachim, Perek Yud. You lift up your second coast of wine. V'kan haben shoel aviv v'im ein dat gaben aviv melamdo ma nishtana halayla hazeh mikol halilot shbechol halilot anu ochlin chameitz v'matza halayla hazeh kulo matza shbechol halilot anu ochlin sh'ar yirakot halayla hazeh maror. So we see here already in the Mishnah, what is this? Ma nishtana. Okay? So we have from biblical times our first real inclination into when people began sitting down at the table discussing Yitzias Mitzrayim. And then we have in the Mishnaic period where clearly Jews are sitting down at a Seder. We have the standardized Manishtana already in the year approximately 200 CE. And of course, if we're saying that this existed during the Mishnah, meaning the Mishnah being compiled approximately 200 CE, this had to have existed before 200 CE. And how do we know that? Well, in our Haggadah that we read every year, we have a conversation which takes place with Rabbi Akiva and others. We have Rabbi Akiva sitting around the table. They're discussing Yitzias Mitzrayim, and of course the famous conversation that ensues lasts so long that a student has to come knocking and saying, you know, Rabotai, my rabbis, it's time for Shacharis. You know, enough talking about Sipur Yitzias Mitzrayim, it's time for Shacharis. So clearly, we know that Jews were already sitting down, again, having somewhat of a formalized Seder during the time of the Second Temple period. And many historians go so far as to say that from biblical time onwards, Every year, Jews would sit down at the time of the first temple with the Karban Pesach and discuss Yetzias Mitzrayim. Post-destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash, it was at around quasi-Seder table, even without the Karban Pesach, but still discussing the Yetzias Mitzrayim. And then, of course, now we have actual written documentation from the Mishnaic period that during the time of the Second Temple period and post the destruction of the Second Temple period, with Rabbi Akiva's time being a second-generation Tana, we have the formulation in the Mishnah of the Manish Tana. You can go even further. When do we see again mention of a Haggadah, or really mention of a Seder, an exact way, a formulation of Jews sitting down and discussing Yetzias Mitzrayim? That's in our third source. The third source, as you see, is from the Gemara. Okay, so we have, again, a biblical verse. We have from that the Mishnaic interpretation going through the formulation of Manish Tana. Then we get to the Gemara. This is from the Babylonian Gemara. Okay, and within the Gemara, again, we have the discussion that there is a mitzvah, and I'll go to the highlighted part, in each and every generation, one is obligated to see themselves as if they went out from Egypt, as it says, and you shall tell you, they saying, because of this Hashem did for me when I went out from Egypt, of course in Hebrew, behold, dor v'dor, chayev adam, lirot et atzmo, ki ilu hu yatza mimitzrayim. Right? So we know that every year at our Pesach Seder, it's not enough for us to just kind of tell the story, but we actually have to get ourselves in the shoes of the Jews who left the land of Egypt. And even more so, Jews throughout the ages have taken that literally, in the sense that the depictions throughout every era in history that we have when we first have illustrated manuscripts, Jews literally depict the time period that they're in, and they formulate the Haggadah to kind of reflect the time period that they're in. For example, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, but for example, the Holocaust era Haggadot, we'll see that many of the illustrations from those Haggadot will picture the Mitzrim as the Nazis, okay? So that's a clear example of kind of the whole Dor Vador, right? Recognizing that in every generation, there's kind of our own self Yetzias Mitzrayim. But moving further into our sources, to understand historically how we can kind of backtrack and look at the first accounts or written accounts that we have, the formula that we have of what we refer to as the Haggadah. The first actual account of a Haggadah, a written Haggadah, the way that we have it now, is from Rav Amram Gaon, which is in the 9th century, the Gaonim of Sura and Pumbedita. And the actual account that we have that's still in existence, where some portions of it are in the Cairo Geniza, we have the Siddur of Rav Sadja Gaon, the 10th century Gaon, again, the yeshivot of Babylonia. Rav Sadja Gaon's Haggadah is not a Haggadah unto itself. We have the Siddur of Rav Sadja Gaon. From the Siddur of Rav Sadja Gaon, we have a portion of the Haggadah. We know that the Haggadot of old were not necessarily written on their own. They weren't their own Haggadah and then Machzer. They had a Machzer, and within the Machzer, they had the Haggadah. So the first copy that we have of a full Haggadah with the text that we have from really the periods prior to the Gaonim is Rav Sadja Gaon. Yes, exactly. From Rav Sadja Gaon's time, where's the next time that we have an actual Haggadah in the way that it's still formulated today? Well, we have one in Ashkenaz, and we have one in the Sephardic world. In Ashkenaz, we have the Machzer Vitri, that is Rashi's student. We know that Rashi's student wrote down Rashi's version of the Haggadah, and he talks about his teacher Rashi, and the version of Rashi's Haggadah, we find it again in the Machzer Vitri. Once again, this is not a separate Haggadah, but it's included in the Machzer, and it's a part of the Machzer for Pesach. The next time we see the actual Haggadah in its full textual form is in the Mishnah Torah, the Rambam. Okay, so we have Maimonides and we have the Machzer Vitri. We're going to take a little step back and look and compare the two versions, both early medieval time period in terms of the 12th century, and look at the differences between Ashkenaz and Sfard, and we'll see that ultimately the Machzer Vitri's version will be the version that Ashkenazim still use today, and the Rambam's version of the Mishneh Torah is the version that Svardim use today. Okay, so we see that both of them emerge in, again, the 12th century, one following the words of Rashi, being the student of Rashi in Ashkenaz, and one, of course, being the Rambam, living in the Sephardic world. So let's take a look at the Machzor Vitri first, and we'll notice a couple of deviances from the text. As I said before, the text of the Machzor Vitri will be the text, the standard text, that those of you who are Ashkenazim in the room will say, okay, this is what I use. Those of you who are Sfarim in the room will say, this is what we use. So the first one, the Machzor Vitri, again, 1040 to 1105 is when Rashi lived. So the Machzor Vitri is going to be writing this, okay, early 1100s approximately, you know, late 1000s, early 1100s, in the 12th century approximately, okay? So the first part we see is Halach Ma'anya, okay, the regular version of Halach Ma'anya. The variance is that if you look at the Halach Ma'anya version of the Machzor Vitri, you'll see that when it says ha, it's the second line here, okay? It says Lashana Haba, and the next line it says again Lashana Haba B'nei Chorin, and then it says Veloaz, which means to translate, okay? So there are two times that the Machzor Vitri uses the language Hebrew, okay? As opposed to Halach Ma'anya, which is actually written in Aramaic, okay? But two times the Machzor Vitri inserts Hebrew language. Okay? Whereas if you look at the Mishneh Torah, the Rambam's work, the same Halach Ma'anya, he only throws in Lashana Haba in Hebrew one time. Okay? So again, very close. Other than that, the text is pretty much the same. But we see that clearly, and there's a whole explanation, you know, along those lines as to why two times, you know, we have Hebrew within the Machzor Vitri and only once in the Rambam's work, but that's a whole explanation unto itself. But to just point it out, there is a little bit of a variation. The next variation, of course, is that little translation word by the Machzor Vitri, which clearly shows in what language do we have that word to translate? French, exactly. Okay, so we see that not only, okay, that little deviation in terms of throwing a little bit more Hebrew in the Machzor Vitri, but we also see clearly that the Haggadah in the 1100s was not only being told over to an extent in Hebrew, but what else do you think was happening during that era? Jews were translating. Okay, in the sense that what we do today. Yes, we try, you know, if we can speak Hebrew, but what if you don't? What if your children may not understand the Hebrew text of Yetzias Mitzrayim? What are you supposed to do? Make it accessible. Translate, exactly. Okay, so we see clearly here from the Machzor Vitri, does it mean that the whole Haggadah was then translated into French? No, okay, we do not have a translation from Rashi or the Machzor Vitri into French. But is it clear that at that point in the Seder, if your children aren't understanding the language that you're discussing, especially since this is Halach Ma'anya, which is in Aramaic, right? If your kids have no clue what you're talking about when you're reading the Aramaic, what do? Translate it, okay? We don't find that word in the Mishneh Torah, but clearly we do find it in the Machzor Vitri. Another deviation between the two texts, we read Manish Tana from the Mishnah. Okay, so if we go back to our original source, again, the original source of the Manish Tana all the way back during the Mishnaic period, again, approximately 200 CE, if you read the Manish Tana, it has the order of the questions. Okay, we'll go back. What are the orders of the questions? Well, the first question from the Mishnah is, Shebechol halilot anu achlin chametu matzah, halal hazeh kulo matzah. That's the first question from the Mishnah. Let's take a look at the Machzor Vitri again. What is the first question that we find from the student of Rashi, quoting Rashi? Once again, we have Manish Tana halal hazeh, mikol halilot, shebechol halilot, anu achlin chametu matzah. Okay? But let's take a look at the Rambam, Mishneh Torah. What do we have here? Manishna halal hazeh, mikol halelot, shebechol halelot, ein anu matzbilin, afilu pa'am achat, v'halal hazeh, shtei pa'amim. Okay, so we have the order of the questions is slightly different between Ashkenazim and Sephardim. That, again, is a slight variance, but there is a difference between the two. It seems as if within the Ashkenazic world, they took the text of the Mishnah, Rashi took the text of the Mishnah and followed along and obviously used that as the formulation of the Manishtana, as opposed to what we find in the Mishnah Torah, wherein the Rambam works off of Rav Sadia Gaon, who works off of the Babylonian Talmud, okay? The Mishnah being in Hebrew, the Mishnah being written where? In Israel, okay? In Judea. The Babylonian Talmud being compiled and written in Babylonia, okay? So the Rambam's work, Rav Sadia Gaon's version of the Manishtana, is working off of the Babylonian Talmud, as opposed to in Ashkenaz, they're using the Mishnaic formula, which comes from Judea, as we know, written in Hebrew. Okay, so again, very, not huge differences, but we see slight differences, and that, obviously, as we know, that there are differences between the Ashkenazic tradition and the Sephardic tradition. This happens to be a couple of them, and it's based on the fact that Ashkenazim, again, go back to the Machzor Vitri of the 1100s, and of course the Sephardim go use the text of the Rambam from his work in the Mishnah Torah. Now, moving down in history, when, again, as we said, we know over 50 million copies of the Maxwell House Haggadah are now in existence. But what about Haggadot throughout the ages, aside from, you know, the U.S.? How many Haggadot were created, and how were they created? So we know, of course, going back to the Machzor Vitri, Rav Sadia Gaon, the Mishnah Torah, they were all included within a Machzor. But when did it start happening that we all walk around with our own, this version of Haggadah or that version of Haggadah? I don't know about you, but at my own family table, we have one person sitting with this version of Haggadah, another one sitting with that version, that one has that version, that one has, so when we get to the same reading, this one says, well, no, I say you do this, and mine says you do that, or my version is this, right? So when did that happen that we all start walking around with our own version of the Haggadah? So that we see in the later medieval world, and you have some photocopies. Okay, the pictures aren't so great here. I do recommend, you know, recommended reading to go and kind of, you know, look up and see if you can get a clearer pictures of these illuminated manuscripts. But we have from the 1300s the real first versions of Haggadot onto themselves, meaning no longer just a part of a Machzor, but beautifully illuminated Machzorim. Sorry, Haggadot. When did this happen? Simultaneously with others throughout that 1300, 1400 world, where illuminated manuscripts became a very popular item, okay? And what within the Jewish world makes sense to turn into its own manuscript that can reflect, you know, beauty and art, makes sense to use the Haggadah, okay? Because it can be onto itself. It doesn't have to be connected to the Machzor necessarily. So we take a look at the first versions that we have, and they're really separated into three. We have the Sephardic illuminated manuscripts, the Ashkenazic illuminated manuscripts, and then we have the Italian. Okay? So the first ones that I have here, the Kaufman Haggadah of Spain in the 14th century, and the Sarajevo Haggadah of Barcelona in the 14th century. Okay, both of these, as you see, are beautifully illustrated, and what we find throughout this period is that many wealthy families, for a wedding gift, okay, or for any other very important milestone in a person's life, they would commission an illuminated Haggadah to be given as a gift. So these are ones that are obviously still in existence today, or we have access to them. And when you look at these manuscripts, you see that they really reflect the art and the history of the time period that they were actually created. But again, within this culture, within the Sephardic world, within the Ashkenazic world, and within the Italian world, you see that the use of the Haggadah changes with the times, and all of them, however, will stick to the same textual versions that we've had all the way back from the Machzor Vitri, as well as the Rambam. Okay, so again, within the Sephardic world, and we see the Kaufman Haggadah, the Sarajevo Haggadah, as well as the, in Ashkenaz, the most famous illustrated manuscript of Ashkenaz is the Bird's Head Haggadah. And the Bird's Head Haggadah is referred to as such because all of the figures within the Haggadah are birds, okay? And that's taking it literally, taking the concept that you can't actually depict a human face, okay, lest you go off, you go astray. So instead of using a human face, you have a bird's head to illustrate the scenes of the Jews being enslaved or the Mitzrayim. It's called the Bird's Head Haggadah, again, because of all of the birds' heads that are being depicted in it. And then we have, and this didn't come out at all in your version, but we have the Italian Haggadah, which is definitely a beautiful and world-renowned Haggadah. And of course, it's in the Italian style in the sense that, as we know, in 1481 Italy, you're going to find not only within the Jewish world concepts of art and beauty, but you'll find that outside in the Italian society as well. And we find in 1481, we have the Italian Haggadah, which again, we still have today and recommended looking at, reading, etc. And then when do... Yes, sorry. It's not named after the individual who wrote it. It's named after those who actually gained access to it and were able to donate it to the library that now holds it. Okay? So that's the... Yeah. In terms of the Sarajevo Haggadah also, it's because it's in Sarajevo, not because it was written in Sarajevo. Okay, so yes, but that's a good question. Yeah. Okay, so that's an excellent question. And that's why when, historically, when you look at the Italian Haggadot, there's really like different styles, and that's why it's Sephardim, Ashkenazim, and then Italy, because Italians or Italian history, as we know from especially the medieval world, is kind of onto itself. Meaning there was such a blend of both worlds in that society that it depends on which one you're looking at. Because you had both the influence of the Ashkenazic world in Italy as well as the influence of the Sephardic world. So that's an excellent question, but I would say it's kind of its own style, right? Because Italy was onto itself because of a blend of both worlds. And then, yeah. Correct. Right. So generally speaking, as I said, it was wealthy Jewish families who commissioned the illustrated manuscripts. So they had access to the money, they had access to the artist. Okay, that's a very good question. And then in terms of the time period, okay, so the Jews of Ashkenaz living in the 1300s into the 1400s, they would not have been assimilated Jews, okay, to the extent that the assimilation that we see that occurs in Western Europe really will occur post-Renaissance, post-Enlightenment, which will happen in the late 1600s into the 1700s. So for the Ashkenaz, I would say that we're not going to really see so much of an influence of the assimilated Jew within those manuscripts. As far as Sephardim living in the 14th century, so that's a hard question because it depends on what you refer to as assimilated versus acculturated, okay? Right, okay. So yes, within Spanish Jewry, there was definitely a higher level of acculturation, meaning blending in with the society a lot more. Were they observant? I can't say yes or no to that question, but we do definitely see a level of observance within the Sephardic community, not as if they're assimilated to the point of marrying out, etc., but we do see a more acculturation both within the Sephardic community as well as in the Italian Jewish community by the point of the 1400s. But then again, within Italy, we note that the first ghettos were created in Italy as well, so by the time, you know, we hit where Jews could reach a point of assimilation, acculturation, Jews are also being ghettoized in Italy, so it's harder. When we get into the more modern period of the late 1500s, the 1600s, the 1700s, then yes, you will see the different versions of the Haggadot, and they will reflect the modernity of the time. Just for an example, if anyone of Haggadah of note is, for example, the Chicago Haggadah of the early 1900s in this country. So one obvious depiction of assimilation in that Haggadah is of the four sons. So when you look at the four sons in the Chicago Haggadah, you have, you know, the wise son sitting with his kippah poring over the Gemara, and you have the Rasha with no kippah sitting with, like, his feet up on the Seder table smoking a cigar. So, you know, you see clearly, you know, the Rasha in that era is clearly the assimilated Jew. Go back a little bit earlier into the 1700s, you'll also see the depiction of the Jew, the wise son, again with the kippah, you know, head covered with the payas, right? But the assimilated Jew, again, no head covering, especially, you know, like the German Haggadah, no head covering and dressed, you know, in like the business suit of the day, clearly showing the assimilation nature of that era in history. So it's a good question, but the earlier medieval you go, the less likely you will find the assimilation and the acculturation. The later you go into the modern period, the more you will see the history of the period reflected within the illustrated Haggadah. Okay, so getting back to our source. We have the printed Haggadah here of the Sansino printing, and as many of you know, okay, the Sansino family, which we still use some of the Sansino works today, the Sansino family post-printing press actually printed Haggadah instead of an illustrated handwritten manuscript. We now have in the 1400s, the late 1400s, an actual printed Haggadah, and from there on in, we're going to find many versions, many more versions of the Haggadah. Why? The printing press, right? You no longer have to sit there and write word by word by word. You've got a printing press, okay? So you can create one copy of the Haggadah, put some illustrations on it, bring it to the printing press, and boom, you've got many. So from the late 1400s till our time today, hundreds and thousands of Haggadot have been printing. As opposed to before, when we only had really three copies of Rav Sajja Gaon's Machzor with the Haggadah, and only three, not really three copies of Rav Sajja's work, but we have bits and pieces, okay, in Karuv Nisa, but three copies of the Machzor Vitri, which now I think two of them are in Oxford, and we have, you know, the Mishnah Torah, but nowadays we have many, many, many versions of the Haggadot, and why? Of course, the advent of the printing press helps to get the Haggadot printed on their own and out to the Jewish people throughout. The next text that we have here, which is very interesting, again reflecting kind of the question of the assimilation, also reflecting the question of kind of the Italian style and the versions used in the Haggadot. This is a fascinating work. This is the Karaite Haggadah. Okay? So to take a step back and look at the Karaite Haggadah is interesting because what we know, and the majority, I would say the majority of the conversations that we have or that we repeat in our Haggadah are based on what types of text? Rabbinic, right? Rabbinic text. We're using the version of the Mishnah for the Manishtana. We're using lines from the Gemara, the whole Dor Vador, Chayiv Adam Leros, right? But we get to the Karaite Haggadah. So they have a problem. Why do they have a problem? Because they only follow Torah Shebichtav. Exactly. Fascinatingly, however, and I wish we had time to kind of look into the differences between the Karaite Haggadah versus the Haggadah that we have today, but we don't. But just to note, again, in terms of recommended reading, but the Karaite Haggadah uses only biblical passages to describe Yetzias Mitzrayim. So they have their own version in which, again, they use the biblical verses, as we saw way back, okay, if we turn back to the first source that we had, in Parshat Vayetzchanan, it's clear that you can actually use the text from Tanakh alone to discuss Yetzias Mitzrayim, and that is actually how the Karaite Haggadah is set up. It's using all of the texts from the various portions within the Bible, okay, the written Bible, to use in, as far as their own Passover Seder. Now going to the last source we have here, which we're going to kind of look at a little bit more closely in terms of the illustrations. And the era is, of course, the Maxwell House Haggadah. Now, what's unique about the Maxwell House Haggadah is, obviously, not only for all of us here, it's relevant being that it was produced in the United States of America, but as we see here, it was first printed in 1932, and it's still printed in 2016. And show of hands, how many people have gone to their supermarket and actually seen the Maxwell House Haggadah sitting? All right, okay, so it's almost everybody in the room. How many people, again, show of hands, use or have used the Maxwell House Haggadah at their Seder? Okay, so it's a pretty significant number. So the Maxwell House Haggadah itself, when did it happen? How does it affect all that we've learned thus far? So it's an interesting story, but in 1923, okay, what did America look like in terms of its Jewish population in 1923 here in this country? Well, you had old German Jews, meaning German Jews who had been in this country for many, many years, really coming around the 1840s. You had Jews of Sephardic and Portuguese, Spanish and Portuguese descent who had come way earlier than that. But 1923 is important because it is a time period in which there has been a huge influx of Eastern European Jews, okay? Eastern European Jews fleeing the pogroms in 1881, again fleeing the pogroms in the Kishinev pogroms of 1903, 1905, fleeing the Bolshevik Revolution, okay, and we can say fleeing and fleeing, but yes, okay, the gates were open in the United States of America, and many, again, show of hands, how many Jews here, Eastern European descent, whose parents or grandparents or great-grandparents came over, okay, in the era of 1881 prior to World War II? Many. Yeah, okay, so that, again, is a time when, in 1923, Jews of Eastern European descent are here in this country, and coffee is being drunk in mass, okay? But coffee is produced through a bean, okay? So what used to happen in Lower East Side, okay, which, as we know, is a hub of Eastern European Jewry. So what happened? Jews would see coffee comes from a bean. It's kibbeh. We can't use it. We're Ashkenazim, after all. We can't drink our coffee. 1923. Maxwell House does something brilliant. They go and they get kosher LePesach certification for their coffee. Okay? Because the coffee bean is not kitniyos. And they get a rabbi to write off that the coffee bean is not kitniyos. So in 1923, the world changes for Ashkenazic Jewry. They can drink their coffee even on Pesach. Because beforehand, okay, the local grocery store, when it came to Pesach, you know, we go to our shop, right, or wherever you shop, okay, and you know that right now, by the way, that the supermarkets have turned over, right? You can't get those chametzik of frozen products anymore because now the freezer section is all kosher LePesach. So what did they do in the early 1900s in this country? Well, the Eastern European Jews are coming. We better get the coffee off our shelves, put out the tea, right? But after 1923, things changed because now Maxwell House secures a kosher LePesach certification for their coffee. Then the Depression hits, things change. 1932, Maxwell House, which, by the way, the Maxwell House Haggadah is the longest marketing campaign in U.S. history. Okay? It is. And it was a brilliant marketing campaign. So what do? How do you get the Jews who aren't necessarily drinking enough coffee to drink your coffee? Well, what do? You give out a Haggadah with every purchase of Maxwell House coffee. Right? Brilliant! And that's what they start doing. So every time you go to the grocery store, if you're worried, and again, a more influx of Eastern European Jews will keep coming to the United States of America, many of them still hesitant to buy that coffee, after all, comes from the coffee bean maybe kitniyos, but here you have very clear kosher LePesach supervision, and you get the free Haggadah to boot. And when you give something out to the Jewish people, and it's free, you better believe they're going to come back for more. And that was brilliant, and still today, again, over 50 million copies of the Haggadah have been produced, and as we saw from a show of hands in this room, many Jews use this Haggadah. Not only those, you know, within this room, but it affected the secular, assimilated population within the United States of America, which we don't even have to, you know, talk about that those numbers today, unfortunately, but those numbers today are very, very, very high. But if you can grab your Haggadah in your supermarket, great, you know, I can bring it home, we can have our Passover Seder, and be done with it. You know, we got our Passover Seder. But that really, in essence, is how the marketing campaign kept going. Maxwell House became, by the way, the best-selling coffee in Jewish households, still, you know, good to the last drop, in the Jewish households. And we see, again, the way that things have changed through American Jewish history, through the different covers of the Maxwell House Haggadah. So let's take a look at these different covers. And this, by the way, if you get the most recent version of the Maxwell House Haggadah, you'll see that it's in the back there. They're very proud of their marketing campaign, very proud of, you know, the fact that it's still going on and many Jews still use the Haggadah today. So you see clearly the earliest version of the Haggadah till today, we notice the different illustrations, okay? Clearly reflecting again the time period of the Haggadah and what sells anyone in marketing or not even in the field of marketing, but as we all know, what sells? Well, if you look, nowadays everyone has a, you know, a iPhone or an Android device, and they keep changing. First iPhone this, iPhone that, iPhone, what are we up to now? I don't know, 5, 6, 7, right? Next will be 8, then 9, then 10. But the truth is, we see Haggadah also changed. It wasn't good enough to just have that original version of the Haggadah Shel Pesach, which looked like it came from the 1930s, because once you were out of the 1930s, no one's picking up an old-looking version of the Maxwell House Haggadah. We need a new version of the Maxwell House Haggadah. And we see, again, for those of you who bring your own Haggadah to the Seder table, everyone and every generation, right? So you have, you know, those sitting in whatever age bracket, and they're sitting with their Haggadah that looks like it should belong to that age bracket. And then you have the younger generation sitting with a Haggadah that looks like it belongs to that. And then, of course, you have the kid Haggadah, which was good enough. You know, I have my oldest is now going to be 14. My youngest is a baby, but I know my 14-year-old definitely is not going to look at the Haggadah that he looked at when he was an 8-year-old. God forbid! Right? And my 8-year-old won't look at the same Haggadah that my 4-year-old would look at. God forbid. But we say, you know, it's jokingly for kids, but as adults we do the same thing, right? The newness. We need the freshness. We need to look at the Haggadah as it reflects what we're, you know, doing in that time period. So again, the Maxwell House Haggadah, the versions. Now what's interesting is the covers have changed, but has the text changed? Now of course, we are changed. The American society of the 1930s compared to the American Jewish society of 2016. Have we changed as a Jewish community? Absolutely, okay? In terms of the growth of various denominations of this country has certainly changed. Even the Eastern European Jewish community that came over from Eastern Europe, and then we know the depictions of some of those Eastern European Jews throwing their, you know, tefillin overboard, or even later on where you have, you know, the first generation of immigrants still with the beard, but the second generation of immigrants definitely no longer with the beard, and the third generation of immigrants without the kippah, right? So that's the concept of, like, what happened within American society. But has the text of the Maxwell House Haggadah reflected those changes in terms of the various different denominations that have kind of grown within this country? No. Okay, to the extent that the text is still the same, and what I mean by the same, meaning there are still a little bit of variations that are added here and there, making it a little bit more clear when you pick up the cup and when you remove the Seder plate, because that stuff is really confusing, right? You have to sit there and read it when you do this, when you do that. But we know that it's not only Karaites who created a Haggadah back when, you know, Karaites were developing, and Karaites, of course, not only have they created Haggadah, but theirs has been reproduced and reflect the new age. But in American society, not only American society, but throughout the world today, there are Haggadah from really every spectrum, meaning there are Reform Haggadah. Okay? Of course, within the conservative world, there are Haggadah as well, and many of them do opt to use the Orthodox version. But within the Reform movement, certainly. Within the Reconstructionist movement, certainly Haggadah on their own. Not only that, but host the state of Israel. I don't know how many people have access to, but if you look at the Zionist versions of the Haggadah, also fascinating. During the time of the War of Independence, plus right after the War of Independence, and even beyond, very, very staunchly Zionistic kibbutzim, their version of the Haggadah is also different. Why? Because once Israel was established, what do you think was clearly taken out of the version of the Zionist Haggadah? Exactly. Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim. What do we need Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim anymore if you got the state of Israel? So that's a clear, you know, indication of how Haggadot have changed. But not only that, but you also have within the era right after the Holocaust as well, okay, during the Holocaust and right after the Holocaust, not only the depictions that change, and we see the depictions of the Mitzrayim and Paro being, you know, representative of Hitler and the Nazis. You see the concept of slavery. Many of the depictions of slavery are depictions of concentration camps, ghetto scenery. So clearly we see that within the Haggadot written or even during the Holocaust. But even addition to that, we also find the compositions of poems or extra kind of versions that are talking about what people went through during the Holocaust. Many of the versions of the Haggadah that we have today include piyutim, which are common to us, which are now included in almost every Haggadah, such as Chagadya, for example, okay? That was not in existence in the Rambam's work. That was not in existence in the Machzor Vitri. That was added on later, okay? So too, we find that in various different versions, again, within the United States in terms of denominations, as well as the Jewish world over, different versions of the Haggadah today, reflecting, again, the actual time period that Jews are living and what's happening within the society of the day. So it's a fascinating, you know, era in history that we're living in now, in terms of not only do we have the printing press, but we have access to graphics that no one had before, right? So we have versions of the Haggadot that were multiplying greatly after the 1400s, and clearly in the early 1900s also multiplying, but now even more so that we have many, many different versions of the Haggadah through denominations, through occurrences that happened within Jewish history, but also the ability to produce various different Haggadot had just made for really an explosion of the different forms of Haggadot that we have. So just to conclude, and I'll take questions if anybody has, but to conclude, what's a fascinating aspect of Jewish history and of our lives in terms of going into the Seder, how do we use this knowledge, the history of the Haggadah? What does it mean to us? Well, the concept of the whole Dor Vador, the concept of really in every generation, we have to really reflect on Yetzias Mitzrayim and what it meant to us. Jews have always taken that literally, in the sense that you can't just sit at your Seder table and reflect what happened back then, or even reflect on, you know, whether it's the pogrom history, if anyone's family fled the pogroms, or survivor's history. But in 2016, again, in addition to the printing press and the graphics and the ability, we're also facing a period in history in which, unfortunately, whether it's the stabbings going on in Israel, or whether it's just attacks on innocent civilians anywhere in France, in Brussels, etc., the fact of the matter is that we are dealing with a time period where it's not enough for us to kind of reflect on what happened way back then, but really to reflect on what's happening now. And when we teach our children or discuss it around the table, we do have to bring in the same concepts that they used way back then. And when Rabbi Akiva was living, mind you, Rabbi Akiva lived through the Bar Kokhba revolt, living through the destruction of Beitar, where we know the streets were filled with the blood of the Jews. And of course, later on in history, throughout these centuries, Rashi lives at a time of the First Crusade. The Rambam's living after the Almohad invasion, okay, which is a time in which you had radical Muslims taking over or forcibly converting Jews in the 1300s and the 1400s. We can go through every century in Jewish history, and yet, in every century in Jewish history, Jews don't just sit there and reflect over what was, but we're always looking forward and using what's happening in our generation, using it to reflect on what do we need to do, what do we need to discuss, and ultimately, how do we conclude all Haggadot, with the exception, of course, as we said, those who got the State of Israel right after the State of Israel, but we always conclude with Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim. And God willing, Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim, you know, we have this discussion, you know, next year in Yerushalayim, but we see again, all of you should be able to bring the lessons of life of old and the current lessons of life to your Seder table to inspire those forever. Okay, question. Yeah. No, there was a question as to whether or not Kidneys, yes, they removed the coffee bean off the shelf. They removed coffee off the shelf because there were Eastern European Jews who weren't buying it. It was a bean, after all. And of course, I mean, new things emerge. Sorry? The tea. Tea. Today, because in 1923, Maxwell House secured a kosher Pesach supervision. It was determined that the coffee bean was, in fact, not Kidneys. Right, by the way, we have the same discussion with quinoa today, right? There are those who say yes, those who say no, but we'll see what happens in 10 years from now. Sorry? Now it's not a question. Coffee is, it used to be, right, but we're talking used to be almost 100 years ago, used to be. That was the question when Eastern European Jews came over here and they really, quinoa. I'm definitely not a halachic source on that. I don't want to be quoted, you know, in terms of what is. That they did. I brought it up because that is an issue. Yes, I don't want to say whether it is or isn't. I know that there is a discussion, but it's a similar discussion to what was once. All right, thank you all. Thank you.